As sure as his resurrection, an Easter sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
He meets us here, not just an empty cross, not just an empty tomb, but the very risen Christ himself, the one who is the resurrection and the life.
We'll send you a CD of this sermon and a sermon on Job for any size gift during the 50 days of Easter. Make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for your support during the Easter season.
When you do a really big job with enormous responsibilities and you are someone of faith, then it's not that you can go and say a prayer to God and he tells you what the answer is on a particular policy question, but it gives you, if you like, a kind of backbone.
So you're getting recipes instead of law, and the recipes are generally about self-improvement.
Faith is a despairing of self, a despairing of our own works, a despairing of our own efforts, a despairing of our own righteousness, and a clinging to Christ and his righteousness alone.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love Issues, Etc.
There is only one man in all of church history who has a creed named after him. That's Athanasius. Now, that may sound somewhat familiar to you, the Athanasian Creed. He didn't write the creed. It's simply an honor that was afforded him by name by Christians who followed him by some centuries. When they penned a creed in answer to the many heresies that were plaguing them, they thought about Athanasius back in the 4th century, who fought a heresy early on, never really lived to see that heresy put to bed, so to speak, put down. In fact, during his lifetime, it pretty much dominated the belief and the thought of Christians all over the world at the time. Greetings and welcome to Issues, Etc. live this Friday afternoon, May the 2nd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be remembering 4th century Bishop of Alexandria, Athanasius. He's remembered by the church on the 1st of May. Dr. James Buescher will be our guest for the first 45 minutes or so of this program. A little bit later, Jim Davis, a new contributor to GetReligion.org, will join us to talk about media coverage of Easter and Mississippi's religious freedom law. Some of the code and the scare quotes that you find in headlines and leads, the kind of things you need to look for in media coverage of religion. In the second hour of the program, the movie's out. It's kind of made a splash. It reminds us of the book upon which it is based, Heaven is for Real. We'll review that book, Heaven is for Real, with Pastor Tom Baker, host of Law and Gospel. Then it's Friday afternoon, so we're going to play Issues, Etc., soundbite of the week in the last half hour of the program. You can go to our Facebook fan page and vote in advance, facebook.com/issuesetc, facebook.com/issuesetc. Listen to those sound bites at our website, issuesetc.org, or you can wait and give us a call, send us an email or a tweet, and vote for Issues, Etc. soundbite of the week in the last half hour, 1-877-623-MY-IE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. or a tweet at IssuesETC. We will be giving away the LPR bundle package, and I have Issues t-shirt, an Issues Etc. travel mug, pen, bumper sticker, notepad, and mouse pad to the listener with the best vote during Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. Join us to talk about a man remembered on the 1st of May, a man that has actually had a creed named after him, 4th century Bishop of Alexandria, Athanasius. Dr. James Buescher, he's Assistant Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Buescher, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
There's a lot known and a lot that we need to say about Athanasius, but what would you say, at least from our 21st century perspective, what would you say is his single greatest legacy left to the church today?
Yeah, you know, Athanasius is so significant to even to narrow down to a single is difficult. I mean, he's involved in so much and is a kind of foundational figure for the church in so many ways, whether it was the New Testament canon, whether it was monastic life and those kinds of things. You know, Gregory Nazianzen, one of his successors there in the 4th century, simply calls him the pillar of the church, or one of the pillars of the church, and I think that does communicate just how significant he was. But I think if you have to narrow it down to a single kind of legacy of Athanasius. It is his just dogged defense of the Nicene Creed, and especially at the heart of that, the Son's divinity and his essential relationship to the Father. I think that would have to be the most significant contribution.
In that respect, and we're talking there about his contention with the Arian heresy that denied the full
right.
divinity of Jesus, and we'll get into the details of that error in just a minute, but at the time that Athanasius is spending both serving the church but also writing against this heresy, writing in defense of orthodoxy, does the church generally recognize his contribution? Is he considered at his time the defender of the faith that we now obviously do consider him?
Yeah, I suppose there is certainly some hindsight, but even, you know, in his own day, he was you know, certainly loved by those that were on his side, certainly hated by those who were his opponents. In fact, as I mentioned, some of his successors, Basil of Caesarea, the Cappadocian fathers, you know, there are letters where Basil will write in his own time there, probably in around the 360s, that he sees the church kind of overtaken by Arians and he sees kind of the darkness that is over the church. But then he'll say in the letter, you know, but then I think about you, Athanasius, and I kind of, my hope is kindled, and he knows how strong a defender Athanasius is. And Athanasius was seen kind of as just a very stalwart, steadfast, maybe even stubborn defender of the faith. In fact, his enemies even kind of termed him the black dwarf, I think, was the name they gave him, which he was a dark-skinned, obviously Egyptian, and kind of diminutive in stature, but he was just so energetic, and they recognized him as just a very difficult man to overcome. He was a very strong opponent. So, yeah, even in his own day, he's going to be seen as a pillar of the church. Now, we, with hindsight, probably recognize him even in more significant terms, but certainly he was a force to be reckoned with in his own day.
As men, did Athanasius and his primary theological opponent, Arius, did they ever have direct dealings with one another?
Yeah, Arius, you know, the situation there at the very beginning of the the debate, Arius is a presbyter or a pastor in the church in a church around Alexandria. He's under the supervision of Alexander, who's Bishop of Alexandria. So Arius, yes, is there. Probably at the same time, Athanasius is probably the right-hand kind of advisor or deacon of Alexander. So they certainly would have known each other. And in fact, you know, that's as the debate grows there in Alexandria and then begins to spread to the whole church, you know, it is also later that it seems that Arius is kind of finally compelled later to kind of sign the Nicene Creed by Constantine, and then Constantine kind of orders Athanasius to receive him back into fellowship in Alexandria, and Athanasius will refuse to do it, and of course that causes some problems for Athanasius, the exiles that he goes through and some of those things. So yeah, they did actually have, certainly originally would have had definitely contact with each other. We don't know how much or how intimate contact, but certainly would have known each other and probably knew each other's writings as well.
So tell us about the man Athanasius, a biography, if you will.
Yeah, I think maybe the main thing to say is just how he dominated kind of the whole 4th century. He's born, you know, at the end of the 3rd century, you know, 295, somewhere in there, 296, and grows up in Alexandria, therefore is part of this transition from the martyr church to now a church after the Edict of Milan in 313 that is now much more politically involved, and in which the court or the emperor certainly has an agenda, even a theological agenda. So he is part of that transition. He one of the childhood stories about him is that Alexander, his Bishop of Alexandria, sees these boys out on the beach, and he recognizes that they are playing church. That one boy is acting like the bishop and actually baptizing the other boys, and he calls them in. He thinks they're being rather irreverent, and finds out that they were actually, you know, this was kind of serious. The one boy who was Athanasius had converted the others, and they were actually going through the order of baptism. And the story is Alexander accepts the baptism into his church and then appoints Athanasius at that point to be his deacon, and he kind of grows up there under the tutelage of Alexander and becomes bishop. But he doesn't become bishop till after Nicaea. Nicaea's in 325. Athanasius is probably there as an advisor of Alexander. But Alexander then dies, and Athanasius becomes bishop in 328. And then is bishop all the way till his death in 373. So he's bishop for 45 years. He kind of, in that time, dominates in many ways the theological discussion of the 4th century. As in the course of that time, if you can imagine, he's exiled five times, spends 17 years in exile of his 45 years as bishop, and is so kind of consumed with writing in defense of Nicaea, certainly reaching out to a lot of different groups of people. I think that's one of the significant things about him is how he does reach out to other theologians in order to gain a consensus. And so he certainly reaches out to Rome and to the bishops of the West. He spends one of his exiles there, certainly reaches out to the Antiochene bishops, and is one who not only is a strong theologian, but is able to work to gain a consensus of other theologians in order to confess the Nicene Creed and to really effectively make the Nicene Creed the standard of orthodoxy.
Dr. James Buescher is our guest. We're talking about 4th century Bishop of Alexandria, Athanasius, on this Friday afternoon, May the 2nd. We'll be right back. Are spiritual warfare and demon possession only found in the time of Jesus and the apostles? The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May is I Am Not Afraid, Demon Possession and Spiritual Warfare. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. I Am Not Afraid, Demon Possession and Spiritual Warfare, The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May. 1-800-325-3040.
A confessional liturgical Lutheran congregation in southeast Michigan in Rochester Hills. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word. That's lciw.org. We gather for the divine service every Sunday, 9:30 a.m. at Lutheran High School Northwest. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word. Find us on the internet at lciw.org.
Historic, authentic Christian radio. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does your church need a backup organist? The Virtual Organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Folks attending last year's Making the Case conference absolutely loved the barbecue from Randy's House of Barbecue in Troy and Highland, Illinois. The pork, chicken, ribs, and beef are prepared just like the old days in a pit cooked over hickory, apple, and wild cherry wood. Randy's House of Barbecue, Route 40 and Troy O'Fallon Road in Troy, and at 2649 Northtown Way in Highland. Randy's House of Barbecue, randysbbq.com.
Well, Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilton. We're talking about Athanasius, 4th century Bishop of Alexandria, giant in the history of the Church's life and theology. Dr. James Buescher is our guest. Dr. Buescher, what was the issue for Athanasius? What was the issue that occasioned both the council he was involved with, but also his life of defending orthodoxy?
Yeah, that's, you know, of course, to reduce that down to a kind of a short explanation is difficult in of itself. But I do think for Athanasius, the issue comes down to that little phrase in the creed, that we say in the creed, which is that the Son is begotten, not made. And then, of course, the next phrase kind of defines that for him when we say that the Son is of one substance with the Father. But probably, you know, more important to him than that, the notion that the Son is one substance or the same substance with the Father, homoousios in the Greek, is probably the phrase right before it, that the Son is begotten, not made, and being able to make that distinction to him is crucial. And maybe to give you a sense, therefore, from that phrase, for Arius, there was no difference between the two. He believed that God was fundamentally transcendent and inaccessible. His essence is unknowable, and his essence can't relate to anything, essentially. So really, for Arius, the only way God can relate with mankind is by an act of will, by creating. And so everything becomes a matter of creation for Arius. This is the way he relates to the Son. Jesus himself is simply a creature. The Son of God is maybe the greatest of creatures, but still he's simply made, simply an external work by God. So Arius, everything becomes simply a matter of the will and an external relation. And the problem with that for Athanasius is that there's no stability in that. It's kind of like the relationship between a master and their slave. While the master may be pleased with the slave at one moment, simply by a matter of will, the master could be displeased in the next moment, right, and throw them out of the house. And in other words, that relation is very kind of unstable, and there's no kind of security in that relation. Thus, for Athanasius, the key is that the Son of God is not made, but in fact begotten. And what begetting is the Father generates a Son out of his own being. I mean, that's the difference. If you think about a carpenter making a chair, the carpenter makes a chair external to himself and makes it out of materials that are outside of himself, and that chair has a beginning in time and has an ending in time. It's completely an external work. But a Father generates a Son out of himself, right, out of his own being, and so he's flesh of his Father's flesh and bone of his Father's bone. This is how Athanasius understands the Son, that he is the begotten one, and that begetting is an eternal relation, right? The Father begets the Son eternally. There's no beginning to that begetting. There's no ending to it. It is an eternal communication, and that for Athanasius is the key, there is now perfect unity in God, but there's also eternal distinction between the Father and the Son, and the only way you can have that is that the Father eternally communicates himself to the Son. Now, the reason that's so crucial for Athanasius is that now it is in and through the Son that we too can be begotten, that we too can be sons of God, and that's really, I think, sometimes is missed with Athanasius, that the argument for him is about baptism. I mean, if we bring it down to its simplest understanding, it is about baptism. And that is that we are truly, how do we truly become children of God and sons of God? And how can we truly call God Father? And for Athanasius, that's what the incarnation, the death and resurrection of Jesus is all about, that he actually brings humanity into his own sonship. So that we too, from within him, can call God Father. Thus, you can say for Athanasius that phrase, begotten, not made, is also a baptismal phrase. That is to say that while we are creatures born of our mothers, In baptism, we are brought into the begotten Son, so that we too are sons and children of God and can call Him Father. And that's the relation that is our salvation. And this is really what I think for Athanasius the debate is all about. If Arius is right, baptism is really nothing more than a metaphor. It's really lost its significance, and there's no real communion between God and man.
So for Athanasius, in response to that Arian heresy that reduced the Son to the greatest of all of God's creations, but
right.
There was a time when he was not, to use Arius's little phrase there. For Athanasius, it's not just about the eternal begottenness of the Son. It's not just about that Son becoming incarnate for us, but it's also about how ultimately that Son has come incarnate, uniting divinity with humanity in order to bring us into the life of the Trinity.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. I mean, that for him is, and I think that's one of the very important aspects to realize here is that, you know, before everything else, Athanasius is a bishop, or we might say pastor. He stands at an altar, he stands at baptismal fonts, he preaches in the pulpit. So his main concern as a pastor is the salvation of his people, is the gospel, is the reality of the gospel being confessed and defended and taking place in our midst. And so that's really the perspective he has, and the kind of foundation from which he argues is that the Son of God actually now, as you say, brings humanity into this relationship to the Father, and in and through his body, we too are brought into this. This is what baptism is to now take our place in his body. And I think it's also, you know, certainly for him was about the Lord's Supper in that regard as well. That, you know, if you're an Arian and you partake of the body and blood of Jesus at the altar, you're only getting the body and blood of a creature, one who's not God, and one who himself needs salvation. And so, really, you weren't getting anything significant necessarily at the altar in the Lord's Supper if you believe in the Arian way of believing. And thus, it's crucially important for Athanasius that when people come forward to the Lord's Supper, they partake of the body and blood of the one who is God himself. And therefore, we have this fundamental relationship with him in the body of Jesus that is our life and our salvation.
So we have this stalwart defender of the Orthodox faith against the Arian heresy. How is it, as you said before, how is it that he gets exiled five times? How is it that at least on several occasions he's nearly killed?
Yeah. I mean, it is one of the interesting aspects of the fourth century is just how, you know, the church was kind of controlled by Athanasius' opponents for much of that time. In fact, one of the key things is that after Constantine dies, and he himself had kind of had Eusebius of Nicomedia as his court theologian, who himself was an opponent of Athanasius and kind of a semi-Arian, you would say. But when he dies, one of his sons, Constantius, finally takes over, and he's emperor really through the 340s and 360 when he dies. And he's definitely using imperial power in service of a theological agenda. And his agenda, quite simply, is the unity of the church. And he thinks that the way to find unity is by a confession that is broad and therefore somewhat ambiguous, right? He wants to unite people, and he needs to hold factions together. At least that's how Constantius kind of sees it. And so he promotes the confession of simply saying that the Son is like the Father. And he wants to leave it at that. In fact, he has a number of councils there throughout the West and the East in the 350s, in which he wants to, he makes bishops sign, and certainly brings pressure to bear upon them, makes them sign the notion that the Son is like the Father and that we should not use ousia or essence language at all. We ought to get rid of all of it. So he's definitely trying to to get the homoousius language out of the Nicene Creed. And he wants a more generic, kind of broad confession that the Son is simply like the Father. And therefore, you know, somebody like Athanasius, who is always going to defend this essential connection between the Son and the Father, that essence really is the only language that distinguishes begetting from making, that a begotten Son is of the essence of his Father, when he continually will defend it, and his kind of stubborn defense, and effective. I think the fact that he's so effective in persuading other bishops and in persuading other groups of people, he often becomes the object of his opponent's scorn, and they are definitely trying to use political means to ostracize him. And so, as you say, he'll get exiled a number of times first by Constantine and then by Constantius a couple of times, and then even by Julian, who is the apostate, who's not a Christian, who's emperor for a little bit, and then even by Valens, the last one just in 365 to 366. And things will not really change in favor of Nicaea until Theodosius I, you know, in 379 becomes emperor. And he's definitely a pro-Nicene. And certainly the Cappadocians, they will be very effective as well, building on what Athanasius had done in creating this kind of consensus around Nicaea. But for a long time, the church is definitely in the hands of his opponents and those who are kind of sympathetic to the Arian cause.
But if I have my dates right, then you mentioned before his death in the 370s. Athanasius doesn't live to see any of that happen, does he?
No, he doesn't. And he dies in 373. He does get to see, I think, the tide beginning to turn. I think certainly with the Cappadocians, their work, he certainly is in a conversation with Basil of Caesarea and them. He also does work on a consensus with Antiochene theologians, and he does see a number of those who are a little bit on the fence. In fact, they were supporters of homoiousion, which simply means that the Son was like in essence to the Father. He does see a number of those theologians start to come his way, and they start to recognize the problems with the Arian position, that we have to be much more forthright on distinguishing begetting from making. So he does see some fruit of his labor, and certainly in the West, he had his supporters as well, in very strongly, Hilary of Poitiers and others. So he does see a little bit of it, but he doesn't really see the final triumph of Nicaea, which kind of happens at Constantinople in 381, and then really not fully becomes, you know, the Nicene Creed really only fully becomes the standard, really, at Chalcedon in 451. So, but there's certainly, he is in many ways the driving force of a lot of that fruit that will come.
Dr. James Buescher is our guest. We're talking about 4th century Bishop of Alexandria, Athanasius. The church remembers him on the 1st of May. Stay tuned. What happens when our theology is driven by freshness instead of faithfulness? I've written an article for the latest issues, etc. journal titled New Thing Theology. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues, etc. journal. Just look for the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. The Wittenberg Trail feature details how Bob Leko journeyed from the Word Faith movement to faith in Christ alone. The free online Issues, Etc. journal.
If any former evangelicals are hearing me speak right now, I want to assure you, you don't have to be a homeless Christian. If you would go to issuesetc.org, look on their website, you'll find a list of churches. Find one close to you and attend that church. There, you can receive the true gospel, you don't have to be a homeless Christian, and they will not call you a backslider.
To find a church near you, go to issuesetc.org and click Find a Church.
Christianity has so much influence our culture that we take it for granted and think it was always that way.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt, talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues, Etc., Making the Case Conference.
And if you move into one of the Mideastern countries where primarily the theology of Islam operates, you can see the influence of what Christianity has had in our culture. Yet, we tend not to really quite to, how shall I say, realize it and appreciate it. And once in a while, we need to be reminded.
You can meet and hear Dr. Alvin Schmidt making the case for Christianity's positive impact on civilization June 13th and 14th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Producing 10 hours of live talk radio every week from a 500-square-foot office in Collinsville, Illinois, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. The Lutheran Church of the Good Shepherd in Greenville, South Carolina, St. Paul Lutheran, Chatfield, Minnesota, St. John Lutheran, Napoleon, Ohio, First Lutheran, Lufkin, Texas, Concordia Lutheran, Sikeston, Missouri, Hope Lutheran, Granite City, Illinois, Trinity Lutheran, Gladson, Alabama, and Lord of Life Lutheran, Chesterfield, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
In the preaching that you hear from your pastors, is your pastor's description of that righteous man, does it sound like Jesus, or does it sound like your pastor?
That whole sense that meeting God would be less like coffee with a friend and more like getting electrocuted, that whole sense of God's holiness has largely evaporated.
All of these point forward to a time when God doesn't pull his punches. And then the Son, the only Son, the beloved Son, the hand isn't stayed. He is killed, and he is the perfect sacrifice for our sins.
If one cannot go along with the picture of Jesus that is presented in these documents, one does just the opposite of the careful historical examination of the issue.
1 hour from now, we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. That's a little game we like to play with our listeners where we play four soundbites from this week's Issues Etc. audio, and then you vote and pick one which should be Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. In the meantime, we're talking about 4th century Bishop of Alexandria, Athanasius. Dr. James Buescher is our guest. All of the things that we've been talking about here, obviously, he's pivotal in his time and for our time as well. Dr. Buescher, is this why one of the three ecumenical creeds is actually given his name?
Yeah, right. The Athanasian Creed, which, you know, I'm not as much up on exactly the full history of that. You're certainly right. It is a pseudo-Athanasian writing and comes rather late. But yeah, I do think it was kind of natural to ascribe this very strong Trinitarian expression of the faith and confession of the faith, and to ascribe it to Athanasius. I think it was kind of a natural thing for the church, to, you know, if such a strong confession of the Trinity, you would naturally associate it with Athanasius. Kind of testifies to the church's regard for Athanasius. Very quickly, he's going to be recognized and called even Doctor of the Church by both East and West, and always recognized that way. It was kind of natural for that creed to be associated with him, and certainly does express his theological conviction, even if he was not its author in an exact or precise way.
I want to talk about two aspects of his life, his contribution to the church, that I think are very pertinent today. One is his willingness to suffer. And I think we can say the man suffers. His willingness to suffer and to kind of be rejected by both church and state in order to maintain the Orthodox faith, in order to defend the Orthodox faith. What is it in Athanasius? I mean, some people, a lot of people probably would have said, okay, we found a compromise. Jesus is like the Father. That's as good as we're going to be able to do. Let's all agree on that and go home. He doesn't. Why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a great way to put it. And it is kind of interesting, I think, that at the very moment, too, you kind of think the persecution is over, 313 and the Edict of Milan, and the church is coming out of that era when they were always seen as external to the kingdom, and certainly Rome, was used to, had these policies of persecution. And certainly the church kind of thinks maybe this is over, in 313. But, yeah, Athanasius will experience, this persecution in a little different way. The full power and political power of the state being brought to bear. And they did put tremendous pressure on bishops to sign these agreements and to come to these councils and sign their name to these confessions of faith that are basically just the Son is like the Father. And so, Athanasius, I just think you do see the stalwart conviction that he has. And I think it is because it's not just an academic doctrine to him. It's not just an exegetical point that he's defending, or just kind of an academic theory he's defending, the Son's divinity. I mean, this is the gospel itself, as far as he's concerned. If the Son is not divine, then we are still in our sins, and our whole faith is in vain. I mean, you can say, I guess, maybe put it in some Lutheran terms, confessing the divinity of Christ is for him the doctrine by which the church is standing and falling in this point in time. I mean, it is, the gospel depends upon that the body and blood that we're partaking of is, in fact, God's own body and blood, and that our baptism, we are truly made children of God. We actually come into this relationship of being begotten or born of the Father. And that we can call him Father. We're not just calling him Father metaphorically. We're calling him that truly, because he truly is our Father. So I do think he knows that life and death is at stake here. In fact, there is one point, in my interaction with him and his writings, and I do think this is part of it, where he kind of accuses his opponents of treating this whole debate like a game. It's just a kind of debate like they would have in the squares in the cities or something, and was just about who could win or who could rhetorically get the upper hand and make the other guy look bad or something. And he kind of, definitely rejecting that whole thing. He kind of chastises them because they're not reverent. They don't recognize that the very mystery of the faith, the very mystery of God himself is at stake here. And therefore, they don't approach it with the reverence or the piety that he thinks is absolutely necessary. So I do think he's convinced of what's at stake is the very gospel itself and the very eternal salvation of his own people. So, I think that's the best I can do at trying to kind of give you a sense of that stalwart confession that he makes.
And then the final thing is, this seems to be the trend at that time and maybe even today, unity at the expense of biblical teaching. You said that, one of his opponents, or a man who ended up being his opponent, was aiming at the unity of the church, which is a noble goal, but was willing to mm-hmm. compromise biblical teaching in order to reach that goal. That's a temptation for us today. What can we learn from Athanasius? Not to compromise the Bible's clear teaching for the sake of an external unity.
Yeah, and I think what you say there is kind of key, an external unity. And, I think it comes down to the way you think of unity. And certainly, the emperor and the state and many leaders in the church at the time were thinking of it as primarily a kind of institutional or political kind of unity where we can kind of, agree in certain broad things. But I do think for Athanasius, I mean, this is part of, for him, this is a theological unity. It's the unity that has its root finally in God himself, right? That this is part of the homoousius kind of confession, that the Son is not even just one essence with the Father, but the same essence with the Father, that there's unity. Unity has its source there. And therefore, that unity is precisely what is accessible to us, you know, through the incarnation, the death, and resurrection of Jesus. This is the unity that is the foundation of the church and really is the only unity that the church can experience and must kind of hold to. So, yeah, he will always therefore see unity in those theological terms, and that when the heretics, and this is, of course, how he hears Arius and his opponents, they are dividing that unity. When they divide the Son from the Father, they are introducing the principle of division and schism that will now infect everything. It will infect the whole church and infect the whole faith and that kind of thing. So I think for him, unity always remains a kind of theological question. It has its root in God's own nature. It's going to have its root, of course, in the person of Jesus in his very body, which is not divided upon the cross. And, of course, that's the unity he's always going to be trying to promote and preach and has to be the foundation for the church's unity today.
Dr. James Buescher is Assistant Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Buescher, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time.
Yes, thanks for having me, Todd.
When we come back, Jim Davis will join us as a new contributor to GetReligion.org. We'll talk about media coverage of Easter and Mississippi's religious freedom law. Stay tuned.
Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+, simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
Christological, creedal, confessional. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.